Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is Pirelli Armstrong Tire versus Walgreen Company. Mr. Cafferty.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Patrick Cafferty. I represent the plaintiff appellant, which is Retiree Medical Benefits Trust. There are several points raised in the briefs, but the key issues for this appeal revolve around Rule 9b's particularity requirement, which is where I'd like to begin. The district court holds us to an improper standard of particularity that's virtually impossible for us to satisfy. The rulings raise a number of troubling issues, in particular with regard to the who element of the who, what, when, where, and how requirements, whether we've alleged sufficient facts to show that the plaintiff has been harmed by the scheme that's alleged, what the district court referred to as connecting the dots between the alleged scheme and the harm that we've alleged. The district court also held us to a plausibility standard whereby the case is dismissed if there are possible innocent explanations for the things alleged in the complaint. I'd like to begin with the who requirement of the who, what, when, where, and how requirements. The who we have alleged in this case is Walgreens, the corporate entity, but the district court held that that wasn't good enough. The district court held that we don't satisfy Rule 9b unless we can identify an individual who made a misrepresentation or omitted to state a material fact. This is a threshold question of law because we readily agree that we haven't named an individual. And as far as I can tell, this court hasn't addressed that issue directly, but it has addressed it indirectly in cases such as Lusby versus Rolls-Royce, where the corporate entity is the only defendant, and there's no indication, at least in the court's opinion, which employees are alleged to have made misrepresentations. Other circuits have addressed this issue directly, especially the Bledsoe case in the Sixth Circuit, and whether you have to name names really depends on the circumstances. Certainly the names of people making misrepresentations is relevant, but it's not mandatory, and it depends on the circumstances. In some circumstances, especially when computer transactions are involved, it may not be possible prior to discovery for a plaintiff to allege who made particular representations. But the circumstances can still be alleged with particularity. Here,
Ms. Cafferty, what would you say is the strongest showing in the pleadings indicating injury in Illinois?
The strongest showing in the pleading indicating injury in Illinois would be we do allege specific transactions that occurred at Walgreens Pharmacies in Illinois. I believe paragraph 35 of the complaint specifies some of the transactions and at Walgreens in Illinois. And
transactions, it's your position, trace to specific injuries? Can be traced to specific injury? I mean, individuals, that is, who suffered injury.
Well, we allege that the plaintiff suffered an injury as a result of transactions in Illinois and other states. But certainly in Illinois, in paragraph 35 of the complaint, we have set forth some of the transactional data from the plaintiff for ranitidine transactions, and members of plaintiffs, and the plaintiff is responsible for covering the third-party payment portion of the costs, and it's particularly compelling circumstantial evidence, and we've reproduced some of that at page 15 of the brief. And a particular patient goes to a number of pharmacies and is receiving the inexpensive ranitidine tablets at all the pharmacies other than Walgreens, and at the Walgreens in Illinois, they're receiving the expensive ranitidine capsules. Now, if all we had alleged was the transactional data, we wouldn't have much to dispute the district court's conclusion that the patient might have had a prescription for the ranitidine capsules when she went into the Walgreens in Illinois in that particular example. But the district court isn't crediting other allegations that we had in the complaint, especially with regard to the Express Scripts investigation, which we've detailed in the complaint, and we even attached the complaint that Express Scripts filed against Walgreens to our complaint. Express Scripts is one of the largest prescription benefit managers in the country, and it began an investigation of ranitidine prescription switching following a QI-TAM settlement between the government and another pharmacy, not Walgreens. And in its investigation, it found that Walgreens dispensed the expensive ranitidine capsules 97% of the time, while the other pharmacies only dispensed the expensive capsules 3% of the time. And that's for Express Scripts' entire book of business, which is thousands of third-party payers. Express Scripts also did an audit of six Walgreens pharmacies to review the original prescriptions to determine if they had been improperly switched. And of 107 prescriptions that it reviewed, accounting for 260 fills, it found that 85 of them had been improperly switched. And that's detailed in paragraph 46 of our complaint.
This is at six different pharmacies?
It's six Walgreens pharmacies.
Now, at any pharmacy, you know, there are lots of pharmacists. You know, they go in shifts and do other things. Is there some kind of documentation that says this is an edict from Walgreens? Or what is there? What else was there to show that this is something that is pervasive other than this statistic? Because it seems to me you'd have to have an awful lot of people in on this in order to pull it off.
I agree. All we have, though, is, you know, we have the QI-TAM case filed by a former Walgreens pharmacist who's
He's accusing all the other pharmacists of participating in this, I assume.
I don't know that he's accusing the pharmacist. He's accusing the company, which he alleges set up its pharmaceutical dispensing computer system so that tablets and capsules would be interchangeable when they shouldn't be.
So in other words, it got to the pharmacist without his knowing there was something going on?
Based on our allegations, I would say that's a fair assumption, because there are thousands and thousands of drugs. And when a pharmacist gets a prescription at the counter, he's punching it into a computer. And if the computer's telling him that it's okay to dispense this particular drug that they have on the shelf for the one that's written on the prescription, he's probably not going to second-guess it. The only one I know that second-guessed it was the QI-TAM relator, who understood that only a physician can substitute tablets for capsules in these circumstances, and the pharmacist can't. The pharmacist can substitute the same type of drug. For example, if there was a prescription for Zantac 150 milligram tablets, the pharmacist, unless it says dispensed as written, which the doctor put on there, the pharmacist is free to dispense the generic version of the drug, and most third-party payment plans are going to push that by charging a lower copayment to the patient. You know, they'll say a $10 copayment for the generic version, but charge them $25 for the brand name. And the pharmacist is free to substitute, and is sometimes required to substitute, the generic for that prescription. But a prescription for Zantac tablets for 150 milligrams cannot fill that with Zantac or a generic version of ranitidine capsules. Only a physician can make that change. And what the QI-TAM relator alleged is that Walgreens set up its inventory system so that it was difficult or impossible to fill the tablet prescription as it was written, and that it had to fill those prescriptions with the capsules. And the effect of that, it's a small change that the consumer might not even notice, but it substantially increases the reimbursement to the pharmacy.
Ms. Cafferty, speaking of that QI-TAM complaint, on one hand, it alleges that it's impossible to prescribe the cheaper form.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, and on the other hand, it states that the computers were set up so the pharmacist could switch the dosages in the Walgreens pharmaceutical dispensing computer system. I mean, how does that match up? I think it seems to be in tension a little bit, those two aspects of the complaint.
They may be. We're secondhand on a lot of this information. We're picking up from the QI-TAM complaint. And as I read the QI-TAM relator's complaint, they are, you know, we're adopting these allegations, which should be construed in our favor on a motion to dismiss, these things are interchangeable when they shouldn't be. And if the inventory includes the higher-priced version as the only thing that they're able to fill it with, I'm not ruling out that some of them might have had the lower cost version and might have filled it that way, but at least according to the Express Scripts investigation, that's where 97% of the time at Walgreens the expensive formulations of ranitidine are being dispensed, that's strong circumstantial support for the widespread nature of the scheme. The district court disregarded the Express Scripts allegations out of hand because the Express Scripts was not the plaintiff's pharmacy benefit manager, but that's too narrow a reading of the complaint. Certainly nothing in the complaint suggested that Walgreens was somehow targeting people whose transactions were processed by Express Scripts as the PBM. On the complaint, which is supposed to be construed in the light most favorable to us, the fair inference is that there was widespread prescription switching.
So we shouldn't look to see whether, from the ESI complaint, whether or not particular areas of the country, since this is a national company, are affected. We just have to presume that Pirelli was injured here in Illinois because the complaint charges a general practice.
Both the Keatam case and the Express Scripts case charged a general practice. I don't recall that either of them specify particular
tours of where the practice is. Is it confined to the Northeast, Southwest? Is it a national? I mean,
we've alleged.
Do we draw from that, or are we to say just that allegation alone, standing alone, is enough to establish injury in any of the 50 states?
We don't have any allegations that narrow it to particular states. And I believe it said in the Keatam case and in the government settlement of the Keatam case involved 42 states, and Walgreens operates in, I believe, 48 or 49 states. So there were a couple states that were left out. But beyond that, I don't have any basis to narrow it to particular states or regions. And certainly Express Scripts app is operating nationally, and if they found that 97% of the time the expensive ranitidine capsules were being dispensed, that the fair inference, construing the complaint in light most favorable to us, is that this is a widespread practice that wasn't limited to particular pharmacies in particular regions.
Mr. Cafferty, these examples you give in paragraph 35, do you allege that the persons holding those, for whom those prescriptions were written, that those prescriptions were for tablets? Do you allege that?
We do allege that. We readily agree that we can't prove it at this point.
Where do you allege that?
We allege that throughout paragraph 1 of the complaint, paragraph 63 of the complaint. Drawing the inference, the reasonable inferences from these allegations are that the patient had a prescription for the ranitidine tablets, and for some reason they're getting the ranitidine capsules at Walgreens, and we're alleging that this scheme accounts for that. We readily agree that we didn't have the prescriptions, and we can't prove it without discovery, but we are alleging that they were switched. Whether we're correct in that or not will be determined through some discovery.
But you are alleging that the switch actually happened, that is that the patients got capsules, not tablets.
Oh, yes. Yes, and if you look at the transactional data, what's striking is the substantially higher amount that the plaintiff has to pay for the transactions at Walgreens, $68 to $71 a transaction, versus the substantially smaller amount that it had to pay for the tablet transactions at all the other pharmacies, essentially $0 to $15 a share. Yet the patient is still paying just a copayment of $8 or $10. So the patient might not even notice the difference. This is a capsule instead of a tablet.
They would notice that difference, I was surprised.
Pardon me?
They would notice the difference between a tablet and a capsule. They look quite different.
Yes, a capsule's a tablet's going to be a hard compound of ingredients, and a capsule's a digestible container of some kind, but it would still be ranitidine, 150 milligram, and they might not notice that there's a difference between the two. But it makes a substantial difference, a small change at the pharmacy counter that makes maybe a little difference to the consumer, but it makes a huge difference to third-party payers, including the government, which joined the Keatam case alleging these violations.
Mr. Cafferty, could Pirelli have determined from its reimbursements in Illinois the ratio of the more expensive to the cheaper drugs?
The ratio?
Well, in other words, what from your reimbursements, you could tell the cost, couldn't you?
Yes. You mean similar to what Express Scripts did?
Right.
I don't believe so. It's a smaller third-party payer, and I don't think it had enough transactions to come up with a statistical analysis like that. The examples that we have in the complaint are the transactions that we were able to find in a review of the data, and I don't think it's susceptible to some. It's not a sample size as big as something like Express Scripts was able to do.
Did you want to save some time for rebuttal?
Oh.
I mean, I don't want to cut you off. It's your time, but.
I'll just make one more point and then save it for rebuttal. Just in terms of the plausibility standard, the district court held that because these prescriptions might have been proper, that therefore we don't satisfy a plausibility standard. But that's the Twombly plausibility standard requires that we tell a story that holds together, and it's not supposed to be a probability requirement. And holding that the possibility that these prescriptions may have been properly filled trumps the pleadings is an improper reading of Twombly. And I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal and turn the podium over to Mr. Andelman.
Thank you, Scafferty.
Thank you.
Mr. Andelman?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Andelman. I represent Walgreens Company. I want to respond to something that Mr. Cafferty said in response to Judge Tinder's question as to whether or not there was any allegation of switching, because as the Court will know from the briefs, our position is they have not alleged that there actually was any switching. And I just point the Court to paragraph 34 of the complaint, in which Pirelli alleges it has no way of knowing whether there was switching, that it reasonably suspects that some or all may have been switched, but it doesn't know that. And in paragraph 36, it says it's suspiciously consistent with what was alleged in other cases, but that they don't know what happened in this case. And ultimately, that's the core flaw of this complaint, is that it does not allege what happened to Pirelli or if anything happened to Pirelli. The notion that they couldn't do a statistical analysis along the lines of what Judge Flom suggested isn't credible. Of course, they could look at all of their prescription fills for these two drugs and determine whether or not there is a difference between the rate of prescriptions at a particular dosage form versus another at one pharmacy or another. They could have done that. And 9B is specifically designed to ensure that they conduct just that sort of pre-suit investigation before they file and accuse a company of fraud. And they didn't do it. And not only didn't they do it pre-suit, they didn't do it after Judge Kendall gave them another chance when she said, the problem with this complaint, she said, and I'm quoting from her first opinion, is that it provides no details to substantiate how it, Pirelli, was defrauded by Walgreens. A substantial part of Mr. Cafferty's argument has to do with the Express Scripts case, which was their response to Judge Kendall. She said, tell us how you, Pirelli, were harmed. And their answer to that was to add pages and pages and lots of exhibits about not a fraud case, but a breach of contract case between Walgreens and a different PBM who isn't involved in any way with Pirelli and isn't alleged to have been involved in any way with Pirelli. Judge Flom asked the question, the first question of the argument was the strongest allegation of injury in Illinois. And there is no allegation of injury in Illinois by Pirelli. Pirelli is located in Tennessee. Its PBM is located in Tennessee. And even giving the most generous construction possible to the complaint, any injury that occurred here occurred in Tennessee, because they've said in the complaint and they've said today again in argument that the members, the individuals who were having the prescriptions filled, weren't harmed They didn't know the difference. The difference was felt in Tennessee at the point of reimbursement. And that really gets to another key flaw of this complaint. Judge Kendall noted that the complaint is so oblique that she couldn't tell what choice of law to apply, but the parties argued only two possibilities, Tennessee and Illinois. And as a substantive matter, even if they had satisfied 9B, they wouldn't have standing and wouldn't be able to state a claim under the law of either of those states. Because in Illinois, to have standing as a non-Illinois citizen, which Pirelli is, the core of your allegations, the substance of it, has to be an Illinois transaction. That's the only way an out-of-state plaintiff can have standing here. And Mr. Caffrey made a remarkable concession in his argument just now, which is that they scanned all of their records, and I'm assuming there are some thousands of records, thousands of members they have, and what they found was one member who ever filled a prescription in Illinois. That member did it 7 times. He filled a number of prescriptions in Mississippi, 7 in Illinois, and then many more again in Mississippi. So the inference there, I suppose, is that he was in Illinois for a one-year period, and he filled prescriptions 7 times here. And of all of their members and of all of their prescriptions, what they've told us today is that's the only thing that touches Illinois other than Walgreens being headquartered here. Of course, the Illinois Supreme Court in Avery said two things that definitely don't create standing, give rise to standing in Illinois, are the corporate headquarters of the defendant and an allegation that the fraud emanated from Illinois. In that case, it was Allstate supposedly having a policy and practice of substituting used parts for new parts. And they said the fact that that scheme was hatched by an Illinois company in Illinois, that doesn't give standing. You have to allege that the underlying transactions were fundamentally Illinois transactions. That's not the case here. And they don't really even attempt to allege otherwise. If it
was, Ms. Allen, would you say that perhaps the district court overstated its position when it said that the QI-TAM suit did not substantiate Pirelli's claim? Would you say at least gets him part way to the?
Yeah, what the QI-TAM the ESI or the QI-TAM, the QI-TAM case, you know, Mr. Lisitsa was a contract pharmacist. So, in fact, in the complaint, they make reference to the fact that he was also a relator in a case against Caremark, or CVS Caremark, which is their PBM. And I think he was a relator in another case against Omnicare. So he sort of went around from pharmacy to pharmacy and apparently generated information that led to him having a nice second career as a relator. And so he doesn't have any particular insight into Walgreens other than the fact that he worked at a Walgreens store as a contract pharmacist for some period. The fact that he alleges that there was a policy, and as the court noted, his own allegations are a little bit inconsistent in a way. He says it always happened. Sometimes he says, it was just difficult to fill it correctly. But even if he had alleged that, it's a little bit like in Twombly where there's an allegation of a conspiratorial agreement. But the problem in Twombly was then there wasn't anything except there isn't anything with regard to parallel conduct except sort of some isolated examples that could easily be explained innocently. And that's the same thing here. These more expensive dosage forms are manufactured for a reason, because they're prescribed sometimes. There are reasons why doctors do it. There are even reasons why doctors would go back and forth between them. The pharmacy companies don't make special editions, and they don't work pro bono. They make drugs in mass quantities because people prescribe them. So the fact that they can identify, you know, 7 prescriptions in Illinois or a handful in a couple other states in all of their records is what they've said, that this is all they've got of what is presumably some thousands of members. That with an allegation from another case that there was a policy, just isn't enough. And I think Judge Kendall was absolutely right to conclude that. And the ESI case, which again, like I said, it's a breach of contract suit between ESI. ESI actually did business with Walgreens as opposed to Pirelli, which doesn't allege to have done business with Walgreens. That case isn't any different. At least there they did a statistical analysis. At least there, even though it was a breach of contract case, they did an investigation and had a basis for their claim. and citing another plaintiff who did their homework and could show, at least at a pleading stage, that they had been harmed, doesn't mean that Pirelli's been harmed. And that's really, I think, all that Judge Kendall was saying to them in that first decision, where she said, you have to substantiate that there was harm to you. The rule that they're positing is would in essence be one under 9B, that if there is a settlement in a False Claims Act case, a relator settlement, then that's a priori evidence of fraud, and all you need as a plaintiff trying to represent a class is to say, I had a transaction or six transactions that are at least consistent. Even if you say in your complaint, I don't know that it's consistent, might not be, but I have something that could be that, and this settlement got announced, and so we should open up the doors to the class action. And I think it's fair for the court to consider in coming up with a rule that puts the burden on them to conduct that pre-suit investigation, that the case they're trying to open the door on would be a massively expensive case to litigate. I mean, Walgreens is in 40, I think they're now in 48 states. I think during this time period they were in somewhere between 35 and 42 states. We have something like 7,000 pharmacies. These drugs, Zantac and Prozac, are two of the most popular drugs. We're talking about millions of dollars probably in litigation costs. I think it was fair for Judge Kendall to say that before you open the door on that kind of litigation, you conduct some pre-suit investigation and you set out in detail how you, the named plaintiff, were actually harmed. I think that's the key point on the pleading. And then I think it's important to bear in mind that even if they satisfied that, it still wouldn't state a claim in either Illinois or Tennessee, which I think are the only two states anyone's argued have potential applicability.
Doesn't Pirelli contend that it also, in addition to a fraud theory, it has an unfair practice theory, which wouldn't be subject to the heightened pleading requirements of 9B?
With regard to that, I think that the courts have looked to the gist of the allegation, so that because the statutes, these consumer fraud statutes, generally say unfair or deceptive, and rather than allow plaintiffs to avoid 9B by pleading disjunctively, courts say, well, what's the core allegation? And if the core allegation is one of fraud, misleading conduct, then they're subject to 9B. I do think that if they were subject to 8A, they would have the same problem, because the plausibility standard to which they're objecting is one that also applies with regard to 8A. And it also wouldn't get them over the hump with regard to their failure to state a claim or to have standing to state a claim in Illinois, or their failure to state a claim in Tennessee, which, of course, we sent a letter to the court yesterday emphasizing this point with some new authority, but Tennessee wouldn't allow them to state a claim, a class claim. It only allows claims to be stated in an individual manner, and they haven't alleged facts that would support an individual claim because they haven't alleged jurisdictional amount with regard to diversity. So really there are layered problems with this complaint. It isn't a situation where she simply held them to an unfair 9B standard, and if she hadn't done that, they would state a claim. They can't state a claim under any of the laws that even arguably apply, and they don't state a plausible cause of action, even if it were unfair, although I think that looking at this complaint, they over and over again in the introduction, in the conclusion, and throughout, they talk about how there was a deceptive or fraudulent practice, and I don't think you can back out of that by saying, oh, but we also said it was unfair. They do also have this theory on that they have an unjust enrichment count that we haven't talked about. And that count, I think the district court was absolutely right to conclude that it's a derivative count of the consumer fraud claim, and that absent an allegation of fraud and absent any kind of fiduciary duty between Pirelli and Walgreens, they can't state a claim under that theory. And their attempt to sort of bootstrap it to regulatory violations, I think, fails both factually, because they haven't actually alleged regulatory violations. Again, all they've alleged is a suspicion or possibility of regulatory violations. But more to the point, it really would be a departure for this court to say that you can state an unjust enrichment claim based on violation of administrative code or regulatory violations where the legislature and the regulators don't intend to create a private cause of action. It would basically create one out of whole cloth or out of the common law. From our point of view, this case is not a difficult one. We think this complaint is flawed on many, many levels, and it just is what a colleague of mine once called a chocolate mess, and I don't think it can state a claim, and I think the district court properly dismissed it, unless the court has other questions. Nothing else?
No. Thank you, Mr. Randall. Mr. Cafferty.
Thank you. Just a couple points I'd like to address in rebuttal. First of all, with regard to choice of law issues, class actions of this nature can raise difficult choice of law issues, and they're generally addressed at the class certification phase rather than at the motion to dismiss phase. This court recently affirmed certification of a multi-state class in the Pella Windows case, which I believe involves six statewide consumer protection statutes. In pharmaceutical cases of this nature where third-party payers are the plaintiffs, the focus is usually on where the consumer transaction took place. And, for example, I believe it's the Terrazosin case, which is cited in our brief. The district court there certified a third-party payer as representative of 13 statewide classes, which is where the transactions took place. And that's the true focus of whether law has been violated, where the prescription is filled. With regard to the supplemental authority that was submitted Tuesday, I believe it was I forget the name of the case, I'm sorry, but it was a Tennessee District Court opinion which was interpreting the Supreme Court decision in Shady Grove, and the defendants indicated that it was a Rule 12 motion, but it was a Rule 12F motion to strike the class allegations. And we're still at the pleading stage, and we're still focused on whether the individual plaintiffs have stated a claim. And whether or not these matters are addressed on a class-wide basis is further down the road once we get past the motion to dismiss, which we haven't yet. With regard to whether the defendant switched plaintiff's prescriptions, maybe we're wrong. Maybe these prescriptions weren't switched, but we have a sound basis for alleging that they were. And we've done so with particularity, and we should not have been turned out of court on the pleadings. And unless the court has any questions, I'll otherwise rely on the briefs.
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Cafferty.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel.